Filmmaking Ideology, the podcast about the 69th best show of the 21st century, hosted by myself, Francois, as always, along with
Ian.
Today we are gathered on a momentous occasion. We are here on the recording February 18th on the 56th birthday of Jack Bauer.
Oh, it's Jack.
I had no clue, but I was looking on Wiki 24 and on this day sidebar that they have on the front page, February 18th in 24, 1966, Jack Bauer is born. So we have another nice alignment.
Wow. Happy birthday, Jack Bauer.
Happy birthday.
We got to get like an astrology person on here at some point.
Yeah, like his birth chart. He was born in Santa Monica. I don't think that they named the his date, his birth time, so we can't get his moon and rising,
yeah.
I think. But
we could speculate.
Yeah, we could definitely speculate. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can kind of reverse engineer it. I don't know how those things work.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, people can definitely tell traits to a certain extent, to a eerie extent, I guess. But we're not astrology people, I assume. But yeah. But it's not our field. But it's an interesting thought to think about. And we are here to talk about
the final episode of the television show 24.
Yes, yeah, we had a good go of it, but we only were able to muster seven episodes for this series, plus one bonus episode. So we'll be bidding you adieu. But in series,
as everybody knows, 24 tragically canceled after its original 13 episode order. But, you know, it lives large in the cultural memory.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually surprised. We will actually be talking about two episodes. We'll be talking about the hours of 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. on day one of 24. I was actually surprised how, like, it's not quite... it's both conclusive in a certain way. Of course, you get Taryn Kim being rescued and Jack reuniting with them. But it's also, like, sort of strangely mixed. Like, you sort of get a quasi-resolution of the Palmer stuff with him trying to resolve not to be not to go forth with Vera Galma stuff. You get Rick escaping on a bus.
Yeah.
And like, it's sort of like strange. It's not like, it's very much a resolution, but you'll also get like I could see Alexis Dreeson, like that's sort of stuff where he's arriving, like driving off, like that could work.
Yeah.
On its own, and I actually think 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., like, I think it's, I don't think they mentioned this anywhere, but I could see them trying to work that as, like, as the beginning of season two. Like, I'm wondering about, like, a version of 24 it's not actually the 24 hours in one season, but it's covering, you know, 13 hours, 12 there, here, 12 hours there, that sort of thing. And I feel like that they sort of almost try to configure this first episode of the new order as like a season two of sorts.
Yeah, it really does feel, I don't know all the details on when they got the full season order. Mm-hmm. But it does feel interesting, like how much, you know, episode 13 is structured as, you know, a kind of finale in some ways, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. While still leaving enough hanging around that there are things to pick up on. And then it proceeds immediately into the next episode, right? I'm thinking that this is maybe why my own memory of this stretch is like a little bit foggy, right? Because it does something I don't think any other season does in that way, which is that, like, it doesn't know how far it's going to be allowed to stretch. So Yeah, it's very interesting. And I do want to say that, like, the one thing that is, I think, enormously bolstered by this structure is that episode 13 is hands down the best Palmer episode, in my opinion. The plot there is really clicking along. Mm-hmm. Penny Johnson-Gerald is great in that episode.
She's like curled up like a cat on that couch.
Oh my gosh, that scene like she is, I think, the first not the first, but one of the key secondary characters, the actors here that, like, she knows what this show is. Like that, that scene right there is like, she knows what she's doing here. She knows what kind of like, what kind of attitude this kind of like palace intrigue stuff needs to have. like it's finally like that stuff is finally feeling, even though it's still sort of disconnected from the Bauer stuff, not for much longer, but even though it's still disconnected, it feels like that stuff is finally getting a certain attitude and energy that that the main plot has had sort of inherently from the start.
Yeah, I like that sort of characterization of attitude. I actually think that the scene between the first scene and episode 13 between Palmer and Mike is like weaker than the previous episode, for instance, just because it's sort of like, it's like, you know, it's not as much in terms of like that policy thing, but it's more like, you know, just like very much back and forth in a way that doesn't quite mesh with their relationship before. But I think that this one, like from there, it's definitely very, like very strong. And you get that, you get him like grabbing Carl by the lapels. And
yes.
Which is very fun.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. And like, we finally get all these people kind of, not necessarily in the same room all at once, but like, that stuff feels like it's tightened up.
Yeah, like it's just like the stakes are more clear now.
Yeah,
like just with the Ferragamo death, like even though it's still ludicrous, it's still like it's a sort of energy booster. I think for sure it makes it more present in a way that I think like 24 obviously is like very much a present show, and like having the threats right there is something that it basically always needs. I think unless I'm mistaking anything. So. But yeah, like it definitely makes more sense that way.
Yeah. And I think too, like there is, I think the first really concrete sense that, we as viewers are watching characters who live and exist very far from where like power, like real power is located. Mm-hmm. Right. And that wasn't always clear in the Palmer stuff. And now it feels very clear. And again, Carl is kind of our as he was previously, he's kind of our window into that, but it definitely feels like you said that the stakes here are much clearer, and so like the results of what happens feels more consequential. Yeah. And also just like, you know, the idea that it's like, oh yeah, there's been this other assassin on the way this whole time, you know. like the kind of relentless nature of the show is still really like part of what helps that out.
Yeah, definitely. Like there's I mean, it's relentless, but also I was surprised in episode 13 that like how there's a measurement to its pace. Like it's sort of, you know, erupting into these gunfights and then moving back. I think like this, the CTU stuff again is sort of a problem in episode 13, especially because the like you said, the Palmer stuff like has this momentum to it. And the CTU stuff, at least, I actually think episode 14 is better for that, but episode 13, it's a problem in terms of just breaking up the flow.
Yeah, we're just, like, waiting on the helicopters, right?
Yeah, that's true. And like, when you said, like, in terms of stretching itself, like, I think that we only see one helicopter. Even though there's, like, a bunch of commando units coming, like, they can only afford one helicopter.
You're so right. Yeah. yeah, that's definitely what's going on there.
Yeah, and in episode 14, they talk about the prisoners being transported, but we don't see any of that. It's just like these. We only just see scattered people going around, and like when Kevin Carroll shows up to get absolutely destroyed, like there's just these random people that you've never seen before that are apparently his henchmen.
You know. It's a show with henchmen, like
it is.
That's what the show is. It needs them. Their presence, their sustainability. You know, this is the kind of show that just needs a lot of warm bodies hanging around, ready to drop. And they do in episode 14.
They do. We should also say episode 14. Well, episode 13 is a. Once again, our man Stephen Hopkins, but episode 14 is the first appearance of John Cassar.
A momentous episode for two reasons. That being one of them. Did you catch the other one?
Yes, I would like you to expound upon that though.
Okay, so there's some controversy though. This is, in fact, the first episode so far where we have seen Jack Bauer eat.
And drink, I think.
And drink as well. Yeah.
he hoses down, like an entire pitcher of water in that interrogation room.
Yeah, he's a thirsty boy. but there is a discrepancy that we are going to have to continue to keep an eye on, because IMDb trivia claims this is the only episode of the entire series where Jack Bauer eats. But the 24 Wiki says that he also eats in an episode in season 5, and based on the wording of the trivia, it suggests that there may in fact be other episodes, that the research in fact has not been done by trained eyes such as ourselves. So yeah, we will continue to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, that's the day 5 premiere. And I think it's a breakfast or something like that. So like,
that
maybe
makes sense.
Possible that he's sitting down but he isn't actually, you know, eating. Like he you don't actually
see like, with the Jell-O.
Like with the Jell-O. But yeah, I mean, like, we need a there's a certain it's like fascinating watching it. Like you said, it is actually fascinating watching it eat, like how he's, it's like this very sort of like mechanical, like this very precise sort of thing. Like, I couldn't quite pinpoint what he was eating. Also, it's like sort of like a pasta thing, but it was like, I don't know, like one of those, pasta salads, I guess you could say. Like, it looked like that for some reason.
I like to think that, you know, CTU just is keeping a big bowl of pasta salad in the fridge for when people come in and debrief. It's a, you know, it's a carb-heavy meal. He's gone a while, you know, at least, you know, 13 hours at this point without eating anything. I thought it was an interesting choice. And, yeah, Kiefer did not disappoint in that regard. You know, and I think this is the kind of show where, like, my understanding is that actors both dread and relish the opportunity to eat on camera. Dread because, particularly in a film, you might have to do it over and over and over to excess, right? And I imagine it's not too dissimilar on a TV show, although there tend to be, like, less takes generally. But but also relish, right? Because it gives you this action to do as a character that is really mundane, but also telling, you know? So yeah, I think that this is a show that I hope takes advantage of this more than just this one time. I hope that the 24 Wiki is correct in this regard, but you know, we're gonna have to watch every last episode to really determine. And then once we've done that, I will, you know, at that point, I feel like I'll be able to go in and edit the 24 Wiki to reflect a more accurate summation of the eating activities of Jack Bauer.
We need to establish like a nice pseudonym for the many editing things that we'll be doing on the 24 Wiki by the time this is done. But yeah, there's a like, it's just like fast, like, you know, like he's just like lifting, it's like he's taking a couple of strands, like skewering them, putting in his mouth, and like this very precise, like you can, like it feels very much like Jack in a way, just like the way that he would eat is this way, just like it's very focused, very minute, I guess you could say.
It's a very martial approach to food, you know, suitable for someone with his background, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just also just funny just seeing that like half eaten plate just in front of him during that entire time he's being interrogated.
Being interrogated, by the way, by Father Phil.
Wait, really?
Well, The Sopranos, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wait, that's him?
Yeah, it is.
Wait, is that the one that in college? Is that the guy, or is that a different father?
Oh, no, Father Phil is the guy that, you know, in the early seasons of The Sopranos, Carmela sort of begins to have maybe some kind of flirtation, temptation with, right? He sort of recedes in later seasons, but does occasionally pop back.
He's in college, yeah.
Yeah.
He's the one that they, don't they talk about, like, that's one of literally two episodes of The Sopranos I've seen, but is he talking about the bridges of Madison County? Or...
Yes, yeah. See, here's the thing. I don't know episode names.
Yeah, yeah.
This is why it's... I like 24. Just give me a simple, you know, time frame. Give me a title. Give me a date.
It's because he has that goatee.
Yes, he has a ridiculous goatee.
Yeah, like he just looks much different with the clean shaven, I think, or like you know, like different enough that I didn't remember him. But yeah,
Paul Scholes.
Yeah, Paul Scholes.
It was really bothering me when he was on camera, and I was like, I know this guy. Why do I know this guy? Why do I not trust this man?
I don't know. Like, I think he was one of the characters that I remembered most vividly, not only because of the way that he eventually goes out, but also just because he has the same first name as me.
Yes, yeah.
Ryan Chappelle. Like, it just like this. I think I always retained that for some reason. It just amused me. I think that someone was named Ryan in 24. But yeah, I mean, like, I think that actually both him and actually Alberta Green are both like doing more better or more interesting work than they have been. I think Alberta Green's like sort of rounded a corner where she can be not actively obstructionist, but also just like, you know, it's in this sort of manner that makes more sense, that doesn't feel as tacked on. That time when she sort of when she talks about how to Nina how she has like she has a very good radar for BS. But yeah, you just get, and like Chappelle's like very much, it's like sort of in the George Mason mode, but he's even more sort of like calm and collected, and like he has this sort of like reptilian nature about him that's really fun.
Yeah, he does. And he also kind of has a you know, there's something about a guy like a younger guy like that being in that kind of position where you're like, mm-hmm. you know, this guy has stepped on throat after throat to get where he's at, right? Like this guy is a weasel. There's no there's nothing he wouldn't do, you know, to secure his position or to advance. Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I think the CTU stuff has helped a lot by Jack being back in the loop.
Yeah.
Or rather them being back in the loop with Jack.
Yeah. And you also get like Milo just reappears after like four hours. He just like appears behind Tony.
Do you think he just like went and like hung out in the break room, like took a nap or something?
I hope so.
Because didn't deserved it. Didn't Nina just tell him at one point, hang around, we might need you, or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. And you get Tony telling him that, like, they're not going to name a street after Jack.
Yeah.
which makes me wonder if there's actually a street named after Jack somewhere in the world. I wouldn't rule it out, but also.
Toronto. They're gonna rename Bloor Street.
Bower Street.
Bower Street. It's close, right? It's close with a enough, certain kind of Canadian accent, you probably wouldn't even be able to tell the difference.
It's weird because episode 13 like has this sort of like very, like I said, like well measured, very strong sort of action through line with it, which has like some great moments and also some very dumb moments. Like for some reason, in episode 13 they felt compelled to make Kim like just absolutely oblivious to every single thing that she's been going through for the past 13 hours.
You know, when they get lost in the woods, I was just too. Like,
and like they have one of the commercial breaks right after they're just stumbling around the woods.
It's again just like the writers don't know what to do with Terry and Kim.
Yeah, and this was actually apparently written by a woman. I don't know what was going on there.
I mean, I think this is one of the things where it's just like, it's not even, you know, I think sometimes people talk about this in sort of a way that makes it seem as if the people creating these things are like actively trying, like attempting to make something that is, you know, sexist or misogynistic or whatever. But I think a lot of times what happens is that you're writing a particular type of thing. You're writing in a particular genre. You have particular tricks to fall back on. Yeah. And those things are loaded down like structurally with these resonances, right? And these stereotypes. So it's like, yeah, okay, well, we need some like we need some kind of conflict within this episode that isn't just, you know, them being chased around and shooting and whatnot. Like, how do we stretch this out over an hour, right? And it's like, oh, well, okay, like the girls get lost. They don't know how to read a map, or you know,
Yeah,
they
I
don't
was
listen.
hoping.
They don't listen to Jack, and they end up somewhere that they can't find their way back, you know.
Yeah, I was hoping that there would be like a sort of generational gap technology thing where Kim would take the initiative and actually like look and
Yeah.
see where they were on the map. Like that would have like I would have been totally fine with that. That would have been an interesting sort of thing, but it just doesn't happen. I
Yeah.
was really surprised that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, and it's like it doesn't seem like that complex of an area. And maybe this is just like the way that it's shot doesn't really give us a sense of this space at
Yeah, you don't
all.
really get many shots of the actual screen. So like
Yeah.
it's like you get maybe one or two shots of Terry refreshing the map, so it's like a little bit it just doesn't quite come across that they're actually lost.
Yeah,
Maybe
and it also seems like the water tower or whatever is higher than everything else, and that from anywhere within, you know, the space that you could run in 10 minutes or 5 minutes, that like you could get to a clearing and see it. And maybe that's not true, and it's just like they just aren't giving us a good sense of the space or not. But yeah, it felt like, again, one of those contrivances in 24. Sometimes they're like very successful and useful, and other times it's just like, and because by the end of the episode it's resolved, and like in the moment it's maybe somewhat effective to like ratchet up tension, but afterwards you're like, that was just kind of dumb.
Yeah, just kept running out to the open.
Yeah.
it's so strange. But man, our gains. Rest in
Rip.
peace. Something I didn't realize until my favorite podcast, The Suspense Is Killing Us, happened to mention it, is that Michael Massey, who plays Ira Gaines, was actually the man who pulled the trigger that killed Brandon Lee.
What?
Yeah, I didn't realize that at all. And it like he's talked about it, like he passed away 5 6 years ago, but like he talked about like how it really messed him up for a long while, like as
Damn.
obviously it did. But like I did not, there's like that was like another sort of fascinating layer that it added to his character. Well, like, you know, just like to the performance, like not necessarily like, you know, just a more extra textually, just like my sort of projection on it. But it was just really strange to find that out.
Yeah, that's, you know, you messaged me about this, and aside from just like my own not understanding, yeah, I didn't realize that that's what you were alluding to. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's so rough.
Yeah, absolutely. And he gets a very good send off in this episode,
Oh,
in episode 13.
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, you just get Jack and him like stalking each other
Yeah.
in the woods.
This episode feels like the climax to a sort of like 90s Hollywood, but not A-list, like lower budget Hollywood kind of action thriller. Like the kind of movie where, you know, maybe they were trying to get Harrison Ford attached, but they had to go with someone cheaper. Like that's kind of what the kind of send off that Ira get. I think it's really effective. Like that whole thing, him going around like trying to snipe Jack, and then the kind of like Jack is following him through the woods, like following the trail of blood and stuff. It's very cool.
Yeah, I like how I think the wiki mentions that it's not a Dragunov, but like a one of the Chinese sort of rip-offs of a
Yeah.
Dragunov, a Norrin code. It's fun,
Yeah.
and yeah, it's just like you get him. Like I couldn't exactly tell what he I couldn't tell if he was trying to mislead Jack by like dripping the blood in a specific pattern or not, or if he was just like just because he was bleeding so badly.
Yeah.
Get him like saying or like, I'm not bleeding fast enough to stop me from killing you. Something like
Yeah, yeah.
that. And you get the that shot of him when Jack steps out behind him, and you get it's a close up, but you still get enough of the background to see like the sort of blur of Jack walking in a frame. You just get the look on his eyes as he
Yes.
realizes. I mean, to be fair, it also did remind me of the start pounding Joker from the Batman TV series, where they were talking like they were talking on the phone, and you just hear his actual voice.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's a great moment. And then the final, you know, guns drawn standoff where, you know, Jack drops. And also just like Ira's realization that kind of no matter what he does, he's a dead man, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That there's no way out. I think Massey plays that so well. You know, just this kind of wounded feral animal, right? Who like is like not even like the survival instinct is gone. It's just like pure death drive. Yeah, it's a really I think it's really great. And I think, you know, again, Hopkins is really so well suited to the material. And it's another as you highlighted on Twitter, like just another really like well shot episode with some really interesting framings. And even despite like some of the sillier plot contrivances, I do like I enjoyed this episode like moment to moment. It was thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, the part with Al Leong, I mean, like
Yeah,
I
ripped to
can't
another
rip to
legend in
another.
the show.
I mean, but first of all, I don't get why Jack was dual wielding in that specific moment. It would have been
Because
much.
it was cool as hell, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I
You know what
know.
I think happened? I think they shot it with one gun, and Al Leong was like, no, I am not
Yeah.
going out that
I'm
way.
yeah, but I agree. Like, is that the moment where like his like Jack's jacket gets tagged? Like he almost gets shot or something like
Yes.
that?
Yeah.
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 I mean, like I couldn't tell exactly how far he was, so like I feel like at a distance one gun might have been better. And also for, you know, sound purposes
Oh, I mean,
for not alerting people, but yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. But also during that scene, Terry is holding the gun right in front of Kid's face. It's
Yes.
like isn't that how Salieh got blinded in The Killer?
Yeah,
Like muzzle flash right in front of her eyes. Like, why
That
is Kim
is,
sitting right there? Why is
yeah. You know, this is another thing where it's sort of like, what? Like, okay, Terry already killed someone.
Yeah.
But also, like, I mean, what is her experience with using a gun? Like, what
That
did,
too, yeah.
you know? I mean, again, it's one of those things where it's like, what is like the tension? Like, what makes for the most sort of exciting scene? And also, I think just like being able to frame those two characters together in that shot, right? I think part of
Yeah.
that is just being like, how do we like actually shoot this and make it look? Because there's like a weird perspective thing going on where you can see both of them, you can see Al Leong kind of walking around, but it's like at an angle where the gun isn't visible from where Al Leong's at,
Right.
but like both characters and the gun are visible from where the camera's at. But
Yeah,
yeah, it's
like
definitely good she didn't shoot. Like Kim would not have come out well from that.
Yeah, like it looks cool, but also like it's sort of cool in the nonsensical sort of term.
Yeah.
But the scene with Jack and Rick, like as like Jack is like has his silencer point, like his silenced pistol pointed at this guy, like in the distance. Like that's a great moment. Just him like sort of tracking that guy, like sort of like I thought he would actually shoot him, but he didn't end up. But like he was like watching and waiting for this guy, like as sort of ran around and then
Yeah.
eventually ran off. Like that, like there's good like tension, action tension sort of moments, like including that scene with Terry and Kim, as odd as it can be.
Yeah.
As distracting as it can be. But like what you said, like there's a certain thing where it can where like there's contrivances like Kim running around running out into the open, like but like then it leads to these good sequences. Like it's sort of there's a weird interplay here, and especially just the stuff with Rick.
Yeah.
I think I've swung back around to Rick just being sort of dead weight just in
Yeah,
general.
absolutely.
Yeah, like he had a good few episodes there, but like it's just like so.
Rick should have died.
Yeah, he should have died.
Does he ever does he come back at all?
He does.
He does? Okay.
I think he does actually.
So maybe I'll change my mind when he comes back. But yeah, I mean, for now, it feels sort of silly in a way. Although that being said, like, I think he sort of realized, I don't really think th like there's any way out of prison here. Like, I guess I think he was able to pick up on the vibe that like this Jack guy is not the most stable person. So I don't know that this is going to come out well for him, let alone myself. So yeah. I think, you know, as far as like a character in a moment reacting, I think he probably makes the best choice to just try and get the hell out of there. But
yeah, I agree. But like, I think that just like the stuff with him running out to the water tower, it's just so dumb.
Yeah, it's that whole thing is, you know, unearned, as they say.
Yeah, I agree. I was immensely amused by Jack essentially doing a last verse of County Jail Gate with him.
Yeah, that like weird lecture he gives. Yeah.
you get like to like move past it, like to become a better person. You have to learn to live with it first, something like that.
Yeah, like second chances are all about taking responsibility for what you did in the first place, or something like that. You know? Yeah, like come on, Jack Bauer is like, that's a real pot kettle black moment. Right? You know, Jack Bauer is like incensed that they aren't just going to be like, oh yeah, we're just going to let this guy do whatever he wants now.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it was fine. They had your family. We understand.
Yeah.
You can go protect this guy that you were like maybe trying to kill, you know, just mm-hmm. a couple hours ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of a silly. That being said, though, I 100% believe that the character of Jack Bauer believes that.
Like, yeah.
Believes that, oh, I need to give this kid a lecture, right? But at the same time believes that, you know, he is exempt from these kinds of rules.
Yeah. I recently, I don't know why I just thought about this, but like there was in criminal law, like there's this sort of famous case where like focused on like that was basically about these men like stranded in the ocean who had to like essentially resort to cannibalism to like survive. And they still, this was in England, they still record, they still convicted them of murder. And like in the opinion, they say, the judges say something like, it may be unfair to hold people to like a higher standard than we possibly could do under the circumstances, but we still will. Something like that. And like that, we like that is very much the Jack Bauer approach.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. As an embodiment of the law, you know, he is he is kind of this ideal embodiment of it, in that, you know, I'll do whatever I think is necessary and it's justified.
And I like how they talk about like both him and Nina talk about like him, like they say, sure, I broke a few laws. Like they just flat out say that.
Yeah.
Which also sort of lent that sort of season two sort of feeling to to the episode for some reason. Like I would have actually liked to have seen, like as much as it sort of would have broken up the flow, I would have liked to see the sort of like the entire debriefing, just him just sort of recounting the entire season, or the entire half season so far.
Yeah, I think this would have actually been a great opportunity for like an old fashioned bottle episode.
Yeah.
I think that could have been really great. I mean, you know, it remains to be seen, because like I said, my memory from now until the finale is like pretty much blank. I know where this is all going, but I don't know how we get there.
Yeah.
So maybe there's just like so much stuff that's going to happen that it wouldn't be possible. But it does seem to me that like a strong move here would have been a hard reset. And yeah, you basically end up with a whole episode of kind of everybody getting the hard debrief, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the pressure being put on Jack and on Tony and Nina again. I think that could have been really interesting to like go from this very high octane, you know, cat and mouse kind of episode to something really, really hermetic and contained. But they do not do that.
We already get like, I was wondering in terms of the like the opening narration where he says that like my wife and daughter are in danger, but and like I was wondering like maybe that's a little bit out of place, but no, there's a guy with a silenced pistol after them already.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Immediately.
Yeah. I mean, I did like actually the sort of way that they handled Nina, just like her, like going her in the field. Well, I know she was in the field technically before, but like just her like going around the hospital, trying to figure out this sort of weird FBI guy. I was also thinking about like what you were talking about, the sort of, animosity that CTU and the FBI, was it the FBI or was it CSI or CIA or?
I don't know about FBI. Okay. I'd imagine they do have a little bit of an antagonistic relationship with with FBI. No, I think that the whole sort of underlying incident that connects Jack with Palmer mm-hmm. and kicks the whole thing into gear is basically sort of like holdover like Gladio operation in Eastern Europe of like CIA was trying to extract some guy that Jack, I don't know if this is like under his responsibilities as CTU or what. The wiki is sort of confusing because it says like Jack goes as like part of Delta Force.
Yeah, I think that he was formerly part of Delta Force, but he was sort of reactivated a few times.
Yeah, because like it's, I think in the timeline this happens just a couple years previous to what we're watching. Like, mm-hmm. it hasn't been that long. And, of course, like, you know, Palmer is the one who sort of signs the order on this. Jack is the only one from his team who survives. And I think the guy gets out and his whole family dies, right? But, like, the idea was that, you know, Jack was going in as sort of, like, the official, maybe on-the-books mission to kill this guy mm-hmm. Who was some kind of former asset or something. And CIA was going in to extract him for future use, right. So I think that's like, and I feel like later in the show as we get more of like the creepy kind of like deep state stuff that that might come up again, that their missions at times might be counter to each other. And I would imagine that that's, you know, true of FBI as well, because it would, like, I don't know how this gets handled in the show, but of course, you know, FBI runs like all kinds of stings on, you know, like terrorist, quote unquote terrorist operations, right? That then you find out, you know, there were like 8 people involved and 6 of them were FBI, you know, stuff like that. So I don't know how much the show deals with that, but I think that like just like on the surface level, there's a certain amount of like interagency politics that are that are like a problem for these people.
Yeah, I feel like the sort of fake FBI guy, like he actually played that more convincingly than the regular 2 random agents that are there.
Yeah, yeah.
They seem more like polite.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what made me think of it, but like it was just obviously like we'll run into this issue again and again. Like I was sort of, I would have actually liked to have seen like just the whole episode of Nina just navigating the hospital.
Yeah.
And speaking of the hospital, like the sort of, you know, the Terry stuff is like still like in terms of her rape is like it's still not quite working, but it's working better in a certain way. Like it just feels more like it fits a little bit more, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the reason for that is that it's actually like centered on her as a character that's had this thing happen. Like it doesn't you know, I mean, the bad thing is still like sublimated within this, which is that it was entirely a plot contrivance to like do stuff. And, it's pretty gross, but that now that having happened, it is like consequential for this character and how she is like dealing with, you know, the aftershock of this. Right. And like, you know, I think we get like the scene with the doctor and when like Kim leaves the room and stuff like that. I think that stuff is well done because it's a lot of stuff is unspoken and it's understated is maybe not the right word, but the way that it feels like it's being handled with care in a way that it wasn't previously. And then of course on top of that, you know, you have this weird Nina dynamic. But yeah, and I'm sort of wondering, I wonder what your read on this is. Like, do you think at this point the writers know what they're doing with Nina?
I don't think so. Just because like it was just so like, I mean, it felt so sincere in the way that like she was talking when like Terry and Kim were thanking her. Like just like the way that I read it. Like obviously like, you know, actually I think for a few, like for like half an episode there, I had sort of almost forgotten that what they were actually going to do, just because it was so like in the moment, so like played straight.
Yeah.
So I don't think so.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Mm-hmm. And of course, like all of this, you know, can be covered up later by saying, well, she was really good at being a,
yeah,
being a mole. But yeah, it does feel like she's still just playing this character in this way, like yeah, not as someone who's going to double cross, because like you do get a sense of her like awkwardness at like kind of like being the one that has to come and care for these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then of course, like the thing with the weird FBI guy, like, you know, there's no reason for her to act baffled in a scene that we're seeing just between her and this other person.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so there's weird stuff like that where it's like, she's not acting. She's not putting on a show for anybody, the character that is.
Yeah.
So like, why would she act this way? Why would we see this? So.
Yeah. And the thing when her and Jack were talking about like someone had to have recruited Jamie, like I don't know exactly why, like, do they mean someone, well, I mean they say like someone in like division or something like that, but like it just feels weird, just like it doesn't quite, like I don't know exactly why someone would have had to recruited her, like I couldn't tell if she was only working there for like Kathy or something like that, and like she had already been turned like when she went in, but like it just didn't quite gel for me, that sort of line of thinking.
Yeah, I wonder too, like with the Nina thing, and this is again where like my memory is just not that sharp.
Sure, sure.
But you know, I wonder if there is, if the character is played in this way, that there is actually at some points some conflict, or whether she is just like stone cold operator, right? And I really don't remember how that comes out.
Right.
But I suppose that in some sense, like one could read this as being like, well, this person is like a bad guy, but also, you know, in the process of doing this job has formed an attachment to Jack that actually is real, and that there is like a tension there between the thing they know they have to do and like how they actually feel about this person. But, you know, that all feels like a kind of like a backfilling for, you know, what is really an exciting, I mean, from what I remember, a really exciting and like shocking twist, right? But that when viewed with that knowledge brings up all kinds of questions about like this character's behavior being all over the place, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Also, in terms of CTU stuff, I did like the sort of like weirdly flirtatious vibe that Albert and Tony had.
Yeah. I like how she's like trying to get to him.
Yeah.
Like it's funny how everybody has like honed in on Tony as the weak link here. you can kind of see how his character, especially in the early episodes, kind of has this big chip on his shoulder, right? Because yeah, immediately when it's like, oh, they brought you into the conspiracy, you're weak, we can go after you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that is a very funny that is a funny scene. I like that.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, they really should have just gone for and credited him as main cast. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's like he just like so central to like most of these, to like a good chunk of these scenes, but it's like throughout these episodes so far. But yeah, like it's, I mean, like, you know, obviously they get probably too generous with main cast casting or main cast characterization further on. But yeah, it's just fun. I love how the sort of break room, like with the coffee, seems to be the default non-holding interrogation room.
Yeah, it's...
yeah, there's a good potential with that, with Tony just saying, I'm not the biggest fan of Jack Bauer.
I loved that. That was great. I think that this is like, again, a product of the way that the show, like in a normal television show with normal episodes where they weren't this real time thing, I think at this point it's like, yeah, Tony would be, they would have like realized, oh, this is a main person, main cast, etc. But within the real time thing, you know, it's like, it's like this weird kind of thing where you kind of float in between from episode to episode, right? And so it's like when you take the thing as a whole,
right?
Like, how are you credited? And I'm sure there's all kinds of like union and contract stuff lying behind that that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. On similar lines, like I was actually really surprised by that scene towards the end of episode 14 where there's the like one of the workers in Palmer's campaign, like, and like there's a like that entire sort of like it's a, you know, it's a good 3-4 minute scene, like obviously that we've had like scenes with non-main cast members before, but like it's like it was sort of like a interesting sort of shift in focus, like of her, like just, you know, of like a focus on a different character on screen for a good few minutes. And of course, I guess to reveal Alexis Drazen is just there. Like, I mean, also like, you know, the travel thing again, but like, I feel like the place where he executes Kevin Carroll is like not that close to where the hotel would be.
Well, you'd think if there was a giant explosion that close to Palmer's hotel, they'd have a little more urgency about
that. Yeah, that, but also like I was actually really surprised that Palmer actually agrees to leave to go to Nevada before he learns about Jack. I was surprised that, like, you know, because he was so like dead set on schedule before. I mean, also he did not actually go to speak about public health in the valley, but still.
Two things about this. One, I think this is again like a way of looking at this as like season 1.5, episode 1, right? Which is that what that scene with the Palmer staffer reminded me of was like the early Mandy stuff.
Oh yeah, sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where we don't really know who this character is or why we're following them, but because we are, we assume that something important is going to happen. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the Palmer stuff, yeah, I do think the Palmer stuff has shifted into a gear where he is like he now has no choice but to be in just practical, non-combative campaign mode, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like he is in it to win it now because, you know, he naively still, like this is still true to his character, but he naively thinks that, okay, well, now all I have to do is just become president and then these people will pay, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he has this kind of like cold, steely resolve about it. And so I sort of read that as being like, all right, this is what they're telling me to do. This is what I'm going to do. And frankly, maybe it's good. If I'm evacuating, that makes it seem like there's a really serious threat. Maybe that helps us in the polls. You know, I think at some point he even kind of like in one of the transitional scenes, even asks like to see the polling on, you know, what the incident, in earlier in the morning had done, if anything, to affect his standing in the polls. This also, I think it's episode 13, actually did air on the day of the California primaries in 2002, non-presidential primaries, but
government. Oh, episode 14, it looks like.
Oh, was it episode 14? Yeah, yeah. Okay. But it did air on primary day. Nonetheless, so another nice convergence of dates.
Absolutely. Just like I think the end of episode 14 is pretty clearly the best episode ending scene.
Yes,
him just like striding to you. It's just, and you get like I like how you get that sort of pan over from Tony to just some random CTU staffer that's there just to underscore the moment.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, like I want to see Jack Bauer, and then it just ends.
Yeah,
and I like how quickly Palmer comes to like the conclusion that it's because Jack wants revenge, which also again just reinforces the sort of idea that Palmer, this is literally the first time Palmer's ever visited Los Angeles.
Okay, but now I have I'm glad you brought this up. All right, because now I have a really important question. Which I don't know why it didn't occur to me earlier, but like Keith's therapist is in LA.
Oh yeah.
So are they from LA? Like, did they live in LA? Why is his therapist just there? This is kind of the magic of the show, is that that's an obvious like That's a question we should have asked immediately about, like, oh, it just so happened that this instrumental person and all of this is just 10 minutes down the road. And it did not occur to me until now, because all of a sudden I remembered that we'd been talking about, like, well, where is Palmer actually a senator at?
Yeah. I mean, like, and it also, like, also a even though despite the sort of, you know, extremely questionable therapist client practices that Farrakhan was talking, was doing, like, it, I do like how, you know, like, you know, my therapist is like someone I would probably like, you know, like I would be, you know, I feel like protective of, you know, like, and then, like, I like how, like, how sincerely Keith is invested in, or like is clearly like shaken up by his therapist being murdered.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's sort of, like, I like how also he focuses on that rather than him leaking the information in the first place.
Yeah.
So, like, it, yeah, like, I mean, it probably wasn't sort of an ongoing thing, so conceivably he might have moved, but, like, again, like you say, it was clearly a contrivance of him just, like, moving to the exact place.
Yeah, I mean, you
but
know...
also, where does Carl live? Like, does he just always live in L.A., I guess?
Carl... And, like, Carl is a creature of the night.
I would absolutely believe. I mean, like, A, I was really surprised at how, you know, obviously another contrivance, but, like, how the Palmers packed their things in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, yeah, I totally believe that Carl, like, lived in a different city every single night.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Like, Palmer is just one small slice of Carl's portfolio. He's a man... He's a man on the run all the time.
Yeah.
It just made me wonder about that question more. And, like, again, I suppose it's perfectly conceivable that, you know, maybe Keith was going to college in LA or whatever, right? And, like, that's where... but I still think it's interesting how that specific question of, like, where Palmer is from... Like, again, it's sort of how, like, the election is a contrivance, right? Like, the details of it don't matter.
Yeah. And I was especially thinking about that in terms of... in terms of, like, when Sherry was talking about how, like, this would be an uphill battle, but, like, literally no sort of political sense of who his contenders might be, like, how close polling actually is. Like, it feels very much like a vacuum. Like, the election is just a thing that's happening in a way that, like, doesn't quite come across in a serious manner.
Yeah. I know later on we get... There are other political actors later on at that level, and it develops. But, yeah, I think it's also just a product of, like, where would any of that stuff go, right? Mm-hmm, like, it really, you know, I mean, it really took 13 episodes to get the Palmer stuff up to a place where it's, like, firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if you add into that, okay, now we have to know about, you know, at least one and, you know, ideally two other, like, potential rivals, or how they're using it, you know, this, how they're reacting to this whole thing. Like, I would imagine, you know, as the day wears on, we'll get, like, some exit poll type stuff.
Yeah.
That'll start to matter. And so we might get a sneak preview at who some of the people are. But, yeah, for now, it's just, like, it's just a plot mechanic. It's not anything else.
It's just very funny how CTU has more politicking than actual politics.
Well, this is, you know, again, this is sort of, like, the interesting thing about, like, really taking that show seriously and trying to read it, is that, the politics is always happening elsewhere. Like, the election is a circus.
Yeah.
It's a show, right? Uh-huh, and, like, Carl, this is, like, Carl's whole thing. He's like, if they want you to be president, you'll be president. If they don't want you to be president... you know, won't be, right? So it's sort of like, it's interesting that the show, not through, I think, any conscious positioning, but the show, like, through its actual text and plot, is basically saying, elections don't matter. they get decided by people whose names you won't ever know. And it's entirely a performance put on. And the real stuff is going on at a level that even, you know, people that you think have power, it's actually coming from elsewhere, right?
Right.
And, like, right now in the show, it's like those people don't even have names or addresses or anything. Like, there's no one you could hold responsible for what is happening. And so I think that's, like, an interesting thing about the show, is that the election actually doesn't matter. Like, what matters is that there are people somewhere who can, at the drop of the hat, like, frame your son for arson and hold that over you. And so then your choice is like, you know, you're left with this impossible choice. And I, you know, I think we've given Palmer a little bit of a hard time. Like, the way he's written is sort of silly sometimes, this kind of idealist and stuff. But it's like, yeah, what do you do here? What is the play here? I mean, maybe you can walk away, and that's a potential play, right? But it's like, then you know that's still out there, right? Like, you can still be used at some point. And so he takes kind of an equally futile but, you know, noble road of being like, okay, well, they want me to be president, I'll be president. You know, like, let's see how that goes for them. So yeah, I think that's really interesting, you pointing that out.
Yeah. I also like the scene where Sherry's picking out Time magazine covers for David Palmer, especially because it reminded me of the sort of the 2006 cover where Obama was why he could be the next president.
Yeah.
Which I see now is written by Joe Klein.
No!
And also, like, I think the reason why that cover in particular stuck in my mind is that there's a, in the top left, there's a picture of a nuke, and it says nuclear rogues and how to control them.
Oh no. All right, I gotta look this up. I gotta look at this.
It's a classic.
Oh dang. Wow. Is that Clint's on the cover too? That's Clint Eastwood in the corner.
Wait.
Clint's take on heroes. Fantastic.
Man.
Wow.
I just remember the nuke. I did not realize that Clint was in the top right.
Wow, that's 24 core. Incredible.
We need to dedicate a 24 core episode just to that Time magazine issue. I'm sure there's like stuff like just like even the pop culture sections that like is like very much in that mode.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have to track down a scan of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure one or both of us could probably probably find it at a university library or something.
I mean, if we wanted to pay $25, we could get on eBay.
Yeah, that would be, having the hard copy would be perhaps even better.
Yeah.
I
used to collect Time magazine copies. I think I jettisoned all that a little while ago, like when I moved to it. Man,
that's definitely like I think that's a thing that is just like missing from like weird stuff that young people do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't collect Time magazines, but I think that's like a thing, right?
Yeah.
You just have like this ephemera that for some reason you kind of latch onto and hang on to.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, I used to be, not to go on too much of a tangent, but I used to be like obsessed. I mean, I feel like this is germane to 24 in
absolutely
some way. Just like I used to like be fascinated just by the covers. Like, I had one of those like Time magazine books that was just like a collection of the covers. I remember when Bin Laden was assassinated and I knew that they would put the X on the cover because of the way they handled the Hitler and Saddam Hussein and like I think one other person, like they just had X's. Man, I feel that the Osama bin Laden red X cover is definitely like a key American image.
We're gonna have to have an episode where we read that copy of Time magazine and also Cy Hirsch's article about how actually it was all bogus and faked. Yeah, I feel like that's going to be germane at some point. So we'll put that in the back pocket.
Absolutely.
Are there other things you want to talk about with the episodes?
Oh, I mean, there was stuff with Jamie's mom, which was I mean, like that was odd. It was just a strange sort of like playing into like the power dynamics in a way.
Yeah, it's one of the times where the show has a loose end that in a more traditional format you could just drop and no one would remember or ask about it, but in the real time it's like this poor woman has been waiting, you know. I also, just in case any listeners know, if you drop $300,000 into my bank account, I will absolutely not ask any questions. Yeah. I don't know what Tony Almeida is talking about. If someone was like, here's 300K, I would be like, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, that would be the only words out of my mouth. Don't tell me where it comes from, because then I have plausible deniability. Please give me $300,000.
Yeah. I am also sad that presumably we won't get very many more good cop, bad cop scenes with Nina and Tony. They're just so good.
Yeah, it's a good dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's also sort of like the thing that they sort of doomed themselves with a little bit, like where they have to like bring in other people to replace Nina when she's gone.
Yeah.
So it sort of doesn't quite, well, I mean, like, you know, obviously it might be a different case, but like, I feel like already like there might be like a hole when Nina leaves. As sort of like, even though she's very much in the sort of supporting role in terms of just supporting Jack all the time, like it's still like she has a good, you know, a good dynamic to her, like when she's written right. Like in episode 13, she's not like in terms of like the sort of early parts, in terms of like just asking like how things are going, like Jack's cell phone is not turned on.
Yeah.
But then like later on, like when she's like with Tony, like it just clicks. And episode 14, of course.
Yeah, I think that like that's something we've seen across the sort of like supporting cast, is that almost all of them really struggle, understandably so, when they're just given no material.
Yeah,
right. Definitely. But that pretty much without exception, when anybody is given a little bit of meat, like they do great with it. You know, which
Keith
is like
Keith is doing a little bit better in episode 14 also.
Yeah, well, yeah, like you were saying before, I mean, that was the first time where I really felt like Keith was like a consequential character and not just like a pawn in this plot, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that, yeah, he's got to have some conflicted feelings about this because this therapist was important to him. And he's not an idiot. Like, he knows that this is weird and fishy.
Yeah,
and, like, you know, I mean, and that's a moment, too, where, like, as a viewer, you're like, if David could just be honest with Keith and just tell him, like, here's what's happening, but like he won't, and so it's like driving that wedge, because like he's trying to protect him but also like it's pushing him away. And I think it's an effective scene, and it's because like the writers are finally kind of attending to some of these things and being like, well, what are the consequences of this, right? Like, how are these characters going to take this in, and like what's it going to do going forward? And yeah, you know, Sarah Clark does great stuff when she's given the material to work with.
Yeah. And I guess like just to talk about the Kevin Carroll stuff a little bit more. You just get Alexis Jason just the like striding forward, sunglasses, leather jacket, putting on leather gloves for good measure.
Incredible. That's like it's in the air. But this is a definite vibe shift in the show. We kind of had, you know, you're sort of like Ira was kind of positioned as a sort of clever, for a while, clever mastermind. Mm-hmm. Then we realized that, you know, he has his own masters to deal with.
Yeah.
But now we just get dumb as hell, Euro trash, assassin core. And it rocks. I mean, it's cool. When that building explodes and, you know, Richard Berge is on the ground and he's trying to reach for his gun, like, that's cool. But it's, like, it's definitely a shift in what the show is doing now.
I like how Alexis has to kick the gun twice. It's like sort of a weak kick. Twice.
Oh, also, stray thought, but at the end of episode 13, do they say or not... toward the end when they're talking about Drazen coming, and I don't remember if they know his name or not, but do they say that he just left Yugoslavia this morning?
I think so.
Yugoslavia is not a country anymore.
Oh my god.
Unless this is yet another divergence in the 24 timeline where Yugoslavia never was broken up. I swear, and I meant to go back this morning and look at it, but Yugoslavia to my knowledge was broken up by the time
I literally just like watched that scene just now, like, just to double check, and Nina does say Yugoslavia. Oh my god.
Yeah, yeah, Yugoslavia. There was no Yugoslavia after like 1992.
This is this and no New York 9/11 are the two the two biggest divergences.
Wow. So like Titoism then is sort of like a still persistent factor in in the 24 verse. I'm gonna have to think a lot more about this. Rebecca West wrote a great book. I think it covers her travels in, I think, the 1920s and 30s, but I think it came out in the early 40s, called Black Lamb and Gray Falcon, which is her travels during Yugoslavia in the interwar period. It's fascinating, you know, and it gets published at the time of the Nazi occupation of Yugoslavia. So yeah, it's super interesting, but yeah, I was just like, wait, what year is this? Yugoslavia, no 9/11. All right.
Yeah, this means that Emir Kusturica's underground is 24 core now.
Yes, yes.
That's a great film.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, wow. I didn't expect this sort of realization. It totally passed me by.
Yeah, sorry, that's my cat.
Oh no, it's okay.
It's screaming at me. Yeah, it just like it's one of those things where I heard it and I was like, wait, what? Why? What is going on here? Okay, so Yugoslavia. We'll have to think about this more. There are a lot of consequences for what this universe looks like.
Yeah, there's so many potential slip ups that might lend additional sort of. Not like an additional sort of haziness regarding geopolitics.
Yeah, that just feels like an especially weird one.
Yeah,
like an accident.
I mean, maybe it's entirely possible that they might have just forgotten.
Yeah, but okay. Known as the state was known as the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. In February 2003. Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was transformed from a federal republic to a political union until Montenegro succeeded. Oh, interesting. Okay,
yeah, it's like you know, there's some like leeway there, like it's
okay,
possible, but still, like, I feel like CT would be more precise than that.
Yeah, so maybe what they're talking about is, you know, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which I guess is still a political entity at this time. Even though, you know, the actual like unified state of Yugoslavia is no longer, you know, this is maybe, you know, maybe I was too hard on the 24 writers, and they actually were really doing their homework, and it's my own, in fact, you know, lack of knowledge about Eastern European politics at the turn of the millennium that is the problem here.
I mean, I wasn't alive during. Well, no, I was barely alive during that time. So, like, I can't tell if people were referring to it like in the news or something like that, referring to it as Serbia and Montenegro or Yugoslavia. Yeah, it's. I still feel like it was probably kind of a misstep.
Yeah, it sticks out in a way that is unexpected. Okay, yeah. The wiki page says the denonym was Yugoslav until 2003, when then people referred to as either Serbs or Montenegrins. Yeah, so, you know, so maybe it was kind of one of those things where, like, the power of, like, the previous nomenclature for the whole thing just kind of held over until total, like, political dissolution of that. Interesting.
Time capsules. But yeah, I think that's everything, right? In these episodes.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I would be remiss not to mention that for sharp-eared listeners, one of the henchmen of Ira, their first name is also my last name, and so that was a funny.
I wasn't gonna bring that up, but like, on air, but yeah.
No, it's fine. You know, this liminal state of anonymity is mostly just a joke now. But you know, it's a little trivia for you all listening now or in the future to kind of comb through and make your guesses. Yeah, I don't really think there's anything else that I've
Yeah.
got here.
I just read the wiki from episode 14. Green walks downstairs and enters the conference room to find Bauer ravenously eating a microwavable dinner.
Is it microwavable? Is that like explicitly in the episode, or is this an
I
extrapolation
would have
of
loved to
like?
see, I mean, we you know, just watch more scenes of Jack just like going putting around, just microwaving dinners, eating jello, throwing away at a chess game. You know, just like, you know, like you said, that sort of 24 before 24
Yeah.
idea. Like, ideally, it would just be him just at the office and just on lunch break and stuff like that. That
Yeah,
would be fun.
exactly.
But we can't, unfortunately, we won't have that. But we will have, we're back on our schedule. I hope that all of you enjoyed our Blur Street digression. And we'll, like, we actually have a good amount of listeners for it, surprisingly. And so I hope that you'll join us on future digressions, and for also the next episode, in 2 weeks' time, where we will delve further into season 1.5.
The Kassar era.
The Kassar era. We actually didn't talk much about Kassar.
We'll have plenty of time. He
Yeah,
directs like 60 episodes.
definitely.
Thanks for listening, everybody.